Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Everyone thinks I had a storybook career, that I just sprang into Disney Channel stardom overnight, made millions, and lived happily ever after. Spoiler alert, I didn't. There were countless failures along the way, and there still are. How I deal with that struggle and how I pivot when failure creeps in is what allows me to keep going, keep learning, and keep striving for balance. The Vulnerable Podcast is an invitation to hang out every week with me, Christy Carlson Romano, as I invite friends, celebrities, and experts for in-depth conversations discussing the good, the complicated, the beauty of being human, and what it means to be vulnerable. Join me every Tuesday as we navigate the ups and downs of my guests' paths to success.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for downloading another episode of The Attacking Scrum. If you've been listening throughout lockdown, you will know that at the moment we've been recording a special series of the show called Dream 15. This is where we get a guest to come on and pick a fantasy team made up of their favourite players. Thanks for all the positive feedback you've sent us on this. It's been really nice to hear people's thoughts. And we've had some really good fun recording these. And we've got some fantastic guests lined up too. So first up this week is Sam Lana, who is a rugby journalist and rugby analyst too. And we had a really good chat, kind of engaging with all things from Japan's World Cup run through to watching Leeds back in the day with Alex Popham and the like playing for them. And as I say, we've got some awesome guests lined up too. So I've already recorded one with James Hook, which was so much fun. He's an absolute blast. Had a brilliant time chatting to him. And that one will be out next week. Really, really good fun that one was. And hoping to get some recorded this week with Ross Harries, who you'll know from Scrum 5 and presenting Pro 14 Rugby 2. But he's also a massive, massive rugby nerd in the best possible way. And we're hoping to speak to top journalist Charlie Morgan as well. So yeah, all coming together. And a big thanks to everyone who's listened so far. One final thanks, of course, to our sponsors at So Coffee Trades. If you want to get some quality coffee, then do head over to socoffeetrades.co.uk. But for now, enjoy the show.
Charlie wants more. Now there might be trouble for Kuoka. Brilliant! Brilliant off the floor! And in goes Matsushima! Unreal!
Brilliant work. Commentator's curse, just as I said, Japan route. Causes Scotland any problems. Brilliant on the left-hand side.
Welcome to another episode of Dream 15 by The Attacking Scrum. This, of course, is the version of the show where we get a guest to come on and choose their favourite players and select a kind of barbarian side to take on another side from history. As well as picking the opposition, the team, they'll also get to choose the ground and the kit, as well as the captain. And I'm delighted to say that this evening I am joined by rugby analyst and journalist Sam Lana. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Nice to have you on board, making your debut on The Attacking Scrum. I'll start by asking you how you found this as a process.
Yeah, well, it was very difficult. It was very difficult. I started off and I probably had two choices that would never have been changed. So they were guaranteed. The other 13, I just didn't know where to start. I forgot everyone who's ever played rugby. Then I remembered everyone who's ever played rugby at the same time and couldn't pick which ones I wanted in which spots. It was really difficult. I was trying to balance between because I saw this as kind of a bit of a Desert Island Discs where you don't necessarily pick your favourite songs, you pick the ones that are most meaningful to you. And that was quite difficult. I was trying to work out what, whether one match was more meaningful than another match, or whether one excellent performance was better than a season of very good performances. And so it's a bit of a mismatch. You'll notice as we go through it, there's two nations represented, perhaps more than you might expect. But it was difficult, but it was great kind of going down memory lane and remembering some of these performances.
Yeah, you're quite right about it being kind of like the Desert Island Disc style format. I wonder where I got the idea for this. And I suppose, you know, being someone whose work concentrates on the analysis side of things, has it been like a bit of a break from the day job to kind of go on a few flights of fancy, or have you kind of stuck to your principles and be very statistically led and basing it on the data?
No, so I struggle with this because I am when I look at games, I do watch them in quite an analytical way, and I've been doing that more and more in recent years. And sometimes it's a curse because you lose some of the pure emotional enjoyment. Most of these people, the games I'm picking them from are games when I was a teenager or a young adult, and so at that point I had no real interest in the analytical side of things. So most of these are just kind of passion picks from younger years, but there's a few which are passion picks from older years, which was nice because it was kind of a reminder that I can still watch games and not just watch them in a kind of a cold statistical perspective.
And before we get underway, Sam, tell us a little bit about your rugby watching background. Where did you grow up? Which sides were you watching? And tell us a little bit about those kind of formative years you mentioned.
Yeah, so I grew up in Yorkshire. I was born in Lancashire, but grew up in Yorkshire. But my dad's Welsh. He played rugby through my childhood. And although my mum was born in Hull, she spent a lot of her younger years in Wales. So we always supported Wales as a family. And that's continued. And I think that's... I often have this debate with my cousins because... when we in 2003, they were so they're born in Wales, apart from for university, have never lived outside Wales. And so we often have a debate about who's most Welsh. And I am of the opinion that if you went to a comprehensive school in 2003 when England won the World Cup and you were 11 and you were supporting Wales, that makes you more Welsh than kind of anyone who was in a Welsh school at that time. But the teams I was supporting, in recent years, I guess for the last 15 or so years, I've been pretty much a fully paid up Scarlets fan. Mm-hmm. But when I was a youngster, I used to go and watch the Leeds Tykes a lot. Mm-hmm. So they're probably they might be the team I've seen most live. Probably went to see maybe 10 or 12 games a season, them for perhaps four seasons. And so I have a lot of love for those old Tykes teams, and there's a couple of picks who I saw as a kid there. But since they've kind of changed the game, how many times they've done it in recent years, and obviously falling away, and I've moved out of Yorkshire, I've moved solely to be a Scarlets fan.
Fair enough. Well, I'm sure, as I say, we'll take that trip down memory lane very, very shortly. But let's start with the front row. Talk us through, who was on the shortlist and who's made the slot in the number one jersey.
Yeah. So I found this really difficult because I started at fullback and I went 15 through to one. And I struggled with loose heads. Mostly, I just kind of struggled to get the person who I ultimately chose out of that position. I selected him early, and then I tried to make picks to remove him. And no one really got that close. So there's not much of a shortlist for this, unfortunately. The person I ended up picking was Geoffrey Jenkins.
As soon as you said, I found it hard not to pick him, I was pretty certain it was Geoffrey Jenkins, because everyone has, everyone who we've had on this podcast to do this has pretty much ended up picking Mellon. And even people who didn't, like me, ultimately I did pick Mellon, if you know what I mean. I did it mainly to be contrary. He's just so hard to look past.
He is. I mean, a big part of that was 2005, his performance against Ireland just cemented him as just such a big part of, I guess, growing up and seeing what it meant to be a flunk, though. And also, from a kind of an analytical perspective, one of the biggest changes that I think has happened in recent years in rugby is the fact that you now have 15 players who can all pass the ball, run with the ball, have pace, have skills, as opposed to just seven, kind of having the early 2000s and before that. And I think Geoffrey Jenkins really embodies that part of the game. He was probably one of the first loose heads to have a genuine turn of pace and be a genuine threat with the ball. And obviously now that's pretty commonplace amongst the front rows, but he really kind of was one of the first to embody that, and I think that not that alone, but that is makes him very hard to get rid of from the kind of the Desert Island perspective, something that means a lot to me.
You're absolutely right, and that 2005 team and that performance in particular. But what's so amazing about it is, like you say, he was doing that in 2005, and when did he make his debut? Kind of a good few years before that, and he went on to play for another 10 years after 2005.
Yeah.
And showed no sign of ever relenting. It was always such an athletic performance. A true legend of the game, really.
Absolutely, yeah. I think he's exceptional, what he brought to the game is absolutely fantastic.
Couldn't agree more. Right, what about Hooker?
So, this one, there were a bit more on the shortlist. Mm-hmm. So, there was Augustin Creevy, who he embodies Argentina in so many ways, in that you watch him sometimes and he is absolutely unbelievable. And you kind of find it hard to believe that he is not known as the best hooker in the world. And then you watch him some other times and you think, what is he doing? This is just awful. And I find that a lot when I watch Argentina, is that they bounce between just being amazing and being very ordinary.
Kind of do it like it's not just like it's one game good, one game bad, is they will string together, an amazing World Cup campaign. And then the following 6 months kind of look hopeless, and vice versa. They are kind of a strangely inconsistent side. Do you think that that's kind of getting better as they've been playing in the Rugby Championship?
It's difficult because they're quite similar to Italy in lots of ways. In that if Italy weren't in the Six Nations, they would be a much higher ranked team because basically they have 5 games a year where they lose every single game, and that knocks them to where they are in the world rankings, which is why I think sometimes it's a bit disingenuous to compare them to Georgia, for example, because rightly or wrongly, Georgia aren't playing the very best teams in the world every single year. I think the same is true of Argentina, is that they probably are the better side. I think they're the more well-rounded side. And I think the Jaguares has helped that as well. But unfortunately, every year they have to go and play 6 games against at least 2 of the best teams in the world. And then obviously Australia a little way behind. And you wonder whether that is actually helping them advance or not. Is it helpful to go and lose 6 games a year? Or would it be better to bounce around playing the US, Canada, maybe those teams. I think in Argentina's case, it definitely is beneficial to get those performances, and they you know, they do occasionally take a scalp, or in the World Cup, obviously they can kind of beat Six Nations teams there. So I think they probably are getting better, but it's just a slow process. Yeah. And it's going to be, there's going to be a long road where they are getting beaten a lot. Yeah,
you're quite right. Anyway, I take us off on a tangent there. Who were the other players that were on the shortlist in the hooker berth?
So there was Ken Owings, which I think is a fairly natural choice. I love watching him play. He is he's just kind of no nonsense. There's nothing showy about him. He's passionate, but he doesn't necessarily show that on the pitch. He just goes about his job, and I think that not just in rugby, there's a lot of people who would benefit from that. Just go about their job, let people know that you are as good as you are by just being very good at the thing you do.
Yeah, I think he's passionate, and you can tell what it means every time he pulls on either the red of the Scarlets or the red of Wales. But I know what you mean. It's not like a niggly kind of. He's not one of those abrasive hookers, is he? Like he seems like the passion he shows is always a kind of a positive passion. You know, whether he's scoring a try or, you know, winning a penalty at scrum time. It's not like that kind of niggly abrasiveness, perhaps.
Yeah, exactly. I imagine that he would be a great teammate to have, because when you're going up and down as the game kind of goes with you or against you, he's just that kind of firm hand on the tiller, making sure that everything's going the right way. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that happens to be a reason why he's often probably undervalued. Mm-hmm. Maybe not so much in Wales, but probably elsewhere in the world, because he isn't showy. He does just do his job. But I thought long and hard about putting him in. Also, Matthew Rees. One of the best things I ever saw Matthew Rees do was I watched the Scarlets in Northampton. I think you went to Northampton University, and Matthew Rees was getting ready to throw the ball in, and he asked for the towel from the ball boy, and the ball boy gave him the towel. Ball boy threw the towel on the floor. Next to him, didn't give him the towel, just threw it down the ground, and you can imagine some other players really getting the hump over that, or really getting angry, or saying something, or it upsetting them for the rest of the game. And Matthew Rees just looked kind of bemused, like a kind of a disappointed grandfather maybe, and just rubbed the ball on his top, and then threw in the line out. It went perfectly, and aside from everything else he's done, Inga Wales, Scarlets, Blues, Pontypridd, whatever, Jersey. I just think that moment was just great. It was great to see someone just take that kind of difficult situation and be like, oh well, this is fine. I'm playing a game I love. We're winning. Let's move on.
Yeah, he is an absolute class act. Actually, we've been lucky enough to have him on and have a chat with him, and he is a thoroughly nice guy.
Yeah, yeah, I can well imagine. He comes across as incredibly nice. So there were a couple of others. I think there was actually Mark Regan, who was the Leeds Tykes.
Yeah, I mean, if we're talking about players who, saying Ken Owens perhaps isn't the more abrasive in your face of hookers, God, Mark Regan's quite the opposite, isn't he?
Yes, yeah. I remember, I think probably I missed a lot of that when I watched the Tykes play, because I didn't necessarily find that out or kind of watch for that. But I remember he made a big impact just watching him play and watching his work rate around Headingley. So he was close. I mean, he was beneath Kang and Matthew Rees, but he was in the mix when I was trying to put this list together. But the person I chose, and this is literally from an analytical perspective, because I think he is the person who embodies. I'll tell you who he is, and then I'll tell you a bit about why. So it's Dane Coles. So the thing I love about rugby, and the thing that when I was kind of learning more about it and looking at rugby from a more analytical perspective, is this idea that you no longer need to have all eight forwards in the middle of the pitch. You know, if you watch any game now, you'll see that the teams spread their forwards, obviously, aren't they? They might have one on the wing, or one on each wing, or two on each wing, and four in the middle, or one on one wing, two on the other. You know, all kinds of formations for how they align their forwards. But whenever I explain this to somebody, whenever I explain these different formations for rugby to people, the person I always go back to is Dane Coles, because he does such a brilliant job either supporting a winger on the wide, or carrying the ball, offloading, passing. And I just think that he is such a good embodiment of that. And his work rate is phenomenal. And his ball skills are phenomenal. And he's really what, if you were the young, not necessarily hooker, but any kind of young forward, I would just say, just watch him. Just watch a game and keep an eye on Dane Coles. Or, yeah, watch a game from the past and keep an eye on Dane Coles. And you will just see what it means to be a modern day forward. To have that pace, to have those ball skills, similar to Geoffrey Jenkins, actually. And so for that reason, he's one of the people he is the person I think is best in boys hooker for this team.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The guy is, his ball skills are superhuman, really, aren't they? I know it's a bit of a cliche, but comfortably good enough to play in the backs of another side.
Yes,
and that does make him a real joy to watch.
Yeah, I think he's fantastic. He made the number two jersey for me.
So you've gone for a very dynamic front row so far. Are we going to have another kind of ball playing dynamic tight head, or are you going to go for someone who's going to offer you some grunt in the scrum?
Well, I considered making it putting Carl Sinclair there and making it a kind of full ball playing front row. I thought about that very briefly, because to be honest, I'd made up my decision before. I kind of toyed with the idea of trying to come up with shortlisted people for this, but I didn't really, it wouldn't have done them justice because they were never really in the picture. It's Adam Jones. And it's, you know, it was always going to be him.
Again, people won't need my take on it. Anyone who's ever listened to this podcast before will know how highly I think of him. Do you have a favorite memory of Adam Jones in a Wales shirt?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I was a particular. I guess the moment I realised what he does for Wales was during the 2011 World Cup. And I think a big part of what I like about him, and this is a bit more, this is quite a, it's a bit broader than just rugby, but I think there's this idea nowadays that kind of, I know that women's sport has a real issue with this, is trying to get people to accept the fact that you're going to look a certain way when you play sport. You know, you're not going to be at your best when you play sport. And also embracing the fact that you're born a certain way, and Adam Jones is born a different way to Cheslin Colby, for example, and kind of embracing the benefits of that. And so I think that's a huge part of what I like about Adam Jones, is that he just got on with it. He also came from being very unfit to being one of the fitter forwards in the world. He's not Geoffrey Jenkins levels of kind of playing the loose, but he managed to fulfil the role that he was needed to, despite the fact that he had difficult early years with his fitness. So I'd say 2011. When that Welsh scrum really kind of started to work, and after many years of it struggling, and he was clearly the player who made that happen. Although actually, as I'm saying this, I realise that my favourite Adam Jones moment is the 2009 Lions first test, when he comes on for Phil Vickery and single-handedly fixes the scrum. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, though, is there's for a front row forward, particularly a tight head, you know, where it could be very easy to just think, look, I know what a good player he was, but you don't necessarily have that many amazing memories. Again, with Adam Jones, I do, you're right, that 2011 World Cup, for that one autumn, I genuinely thought we were going to win it, and he was an integral part of that. And you're right, 2009, he was just superb. That second test with the All-Welsh front row was absolutely incredible. 2013, demolishing the England scrum in the millennium. You know, I think that genuinely, you can... it's very hard to debate between eras, but I think most people would... I don't think anyone would really have a problem in arguing that he's Wales's greatest ever tight head, and I include... You know, I think even Graham Price would happily admit that as well. You know, they're just players of, and particularly Adam Jones has just achieved so much in a red jersey.
And also now going on to coaching and kind of passing along, I think that's fantastic. And he's actually just at the centre of so many great Welsh rugby memories. You know, he is just there for so many of them. And I think that longevity and just being able to keep getting picked is one of the things that has made him, has basically made him a shoo-in for the squad.
Absolutely. Right. What about the second row then?
So, I mean, one second though, is obvious. It's Alan Wynne-Jones. I tried really hard to be controversial with this one. I'm not controversial, but I kind of thought, well, everyone's going to pick Alan Wynne-Jones. I'll pick someone different. And I just couldn't think of anyone who does a better job than he does. He is one of the probably five, maybe three best players in the world at the moment. He is possibly, in my lifetime, the best Wales captain we've ever had, just in terms of how he conducts himself, how he gets the team moving in the same direction, how he speaks to the referee, how he talks to the media. I'd say Sam Warburton is pushing that. I know that he kind of made the captaincy a bit more modern, but I think that Alan Wynne-Jones has taken that and run with it. And he's just being ever present. Same with Adam Jones, really. He's just ever present. He's always there. He always does the jobs that you kind of appreciate more once you get to know them, be a little bit better. He kind of does the hidden work really well. But then he's also kind of, you know, he makes big hits, he turns ball over, he operates as a good link man. He does all those things. And I do think that because he's not necessarily showy, because he comes across as perhaps a bit demure off the pitch, people underestimate him, not in Wales again, but outside Wales. And I just think that kind of thought is mad, because he is, as I say, one of the top three or one of the top five best players in the world at the moment.
He picks himself for any Welsh rugby fan in one of these Dream 15 scenarios. Who would be partnering with him then?
So this one I found harder. What I was trying to do at this point was pick someone who has a kind of an emotional meaning for me. People who kind of got in the shortlist was Luke Charteris, who I think is kind of criminally overlooked.
100% agree. 100% agree. Yeah.
Just brilliant in so many different ways. I don't really remember him ever having a bad game. He must have done, but I don't really remember it.
It took him a little while, and you know, kind of hadn't really made that shirt his own, mainly because there was a lot of competition at the time. You know, there was Bradley Davis, there was Ian Evans, there was Ian Goff at a certain point as well. And it was just before 2011 World Cup, he kind of made this great run of form, and he was absolutely incredible in that World Cup performance. And I think from that point in, really made the shirt his own and kind of filled it again in 2015. Yeah, he's an absolutely superb player and defensively incredible.
Yeah, 100%. And yeah, his work at the line out as well is just, as you expect from his size, is fantastic. Also, Paul Tito, Haga came with a good shout here. I ended up watching quite a few Blues games because my cousins and grandparents are in the kind of the Cardiff area, and I just again, someone I never really saw have a bad game. His work rate, once I kind of started to understand to look for the hidden work, and he was one of the first people that I kind of tried to focus on to see what else he was doing around the pitch. And he was just exceptional. You know, he was his work rate was just absolutely incredible. And you know, such a really good servant for the Blues. Obviously not Welsh himself, but just kind of just did such a good job for them. So he kind of got into the mix. But he wasn't the person I chose. So the person I chose, if this was a team I was selecting today, wouldn't make the mix, but does make it because when I first kind of, when the Pro 14 or Pro 12, as it was then, first came onto the BBC and you could watch a bunch of games. I remember I ended up watching a lot of Glasgow Warriors games and the person I chose was Nakalawa.
Yeah.
Just because I remember him being absolutely sensational. I remember one season, I can't honestly think where it was, you know, maybe 2016, 17, and just every one of the kind of maybe 8 or 9 games I saw across the Pro 14 then and the Heineken Cup, he was absolutely incredible. And I don't think, even including Alan Wynne-Jones in this, I don't think I've ever seen anyone put together such a run of spectacular performances as he did then.
It is hard to really stand out as a second row, isn't it? It's a bit of a thankless job that you have to do a lot of hitting rucks, a lot of tackling, a lot of line out work that doesn't necessarily go noticed. But what he could do with the ball in hand, you know, he holds the ball and makes it look like a peanut, doesn't he? And he can just throw these outrageous offloads. And he is one of those second rows who it's just sheer joy to watch you play.
Yeah, yeah, he is. I mean, I think now his skill. The problem is his fame has passed his skill. I think now. I think the skill is on the way down a little bit and the fame is still on the way up. And so, against Uruguay, for example, he threw so many offloads that didn't work. And one of them actually led to the Santiago Alata try that put Uruguay in the lead. And so I do think that, which is why I say that at this moment, I wouldn't actually pick him if this was a team I was hoping to play with. But yes, for those few years where he was probably the best ball playing forward in the world, definitely the best ball playing second row. I think he has to make the team.
Well, you can have the 2016-17 vintage Nakarawa.
That'd be perfect.
I think that's a mighty fine choice. Right, let's have a look at the back row, Sam.
Yes. So six, I went. I diverged again. I moved away from Wales, but only slightly. I went with John Barkley. So again, I watched a lot of him for Glasgow. It seemed like there was a lot of Glasgow games on at that time, and I was a big fan of the Killer Bees era of the Scottish back row.
Yeah, it's such a terrible name, but I can't shake it. Like, yeah, you're right. They were all great, actually, wasn't it? Yeah. BT Barkley and Brown, wasn't it? The Killer Bees.
Yes. Yeah. What's interesting about it is that the Killer Bees, because I was looking at this early today, I would have assumed that for Killer Bees, they would have gone, the way they'd have written it was B-double-E-S. Because I know I know it's just B-S, I guess B, you know, Bees, but I kind of thought maybe they'd have kept with that. It could be B spelt with two E's kind of works as a pun. But they did just spell it Killer B then S, which seems to kind of undo the vaguely entertaining in pun that they were going for there. But it was when he came to the Scarlets I really kind of, well, first of all, great captain. Also, just the amount he gave for the club and the performances he put in. Again, actually, I'm kind of realising a big trend of this, of what who I'm picking at, is now the people who do the work that perhaps doesn't go seen. I just think watching him, some of the performances put out were absolutely incredible. And he made that back row really click. Even when there was younger players in there, James Davis, Josh McLeod, Ty Byrne in the second row or moving back to six, he just kind of was a fulcrum that they all worked around.
Yeah, and playing 6, 7, and 8 equally comfortably.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. His own killer bee. He managed to fill all those back rows.
Yeah, I just think. Great choice.
Yeah, so he makes my 6. 7. I mean, 7 was so hard. Was really hard. There's obviously Justin Timberlake, who I think is just probably one of the best players around in the world at the moment. I mean, the 2013 Wales versus England game is probably my fondest rugby memory. I watched it in an English rugby club where not only was I the only Welsh person, I was the only non-English person in a crowd of about 40. And to watch that game, knowing that not only did we... I mean, it would have been nice if we'd have won and to have prevented them getting the Grand Slam, but to win and to win by enough to win the Six Nations, I actually think that is a better... that means more than some of the Grand Slam winning performances.
I know what you mean, because the thing is, we don't beat England by that much. You know, we just don't. I'm fortunate enough to remember kind of... I guess both eras against England, the recent modern era where we've had a lot of success against them and the era when we were terrible. And you know, I've got lots of memories of growing up getting stuffed by England, but then I've also got these memories of beating England, and that's the only one where we've hammered them. Every other game has been narrow. You know, in Grand Slam winning years, it's been narrow wins. Whereas that game, we blew them away.
Yeah. Yeah, it was spectacular. It was, and also it was actually quite close for quite a long time, and then it just edged away, and then it was just a complete domination then for the ending. I just thought it was just a sensational game.
Yeah, I think in the back of my head, I seem to remember maybe did Bigger drop a goal or two
yes.
At the start of the second half or at the end of the first, and it just gave that bit of breathing space that then meant England were chasing the game, and that's when we did it with those two tries you know, from fairly far out.
Yes, yeah, and I actually, so the second shortlisted choice I had here features in one of those tries, which was Sam Warburton, who, I mean, just still kind of criminally undulated, I think, because he wasn't necessarily the best attacker. You know, he was good in attack, but he wasn't, you know, wasn't the best. But his working defence, his working just kind of, I guess, what he did with the Jackal and what he did with turning ball over and look, I do genuinely think kind of revolutionised the game. You know, the amount that he brought to that was just incredible.
I think it certainly did in the Northern Hemisphere, and particularly within kind of the British Isles, I would say. You know, for me, again, it's he will be judged against his peers wearing the 7 jerseys, so the Pococks and the McCaws and those kind of players. But for me, what made him so impressive was he can go toe-to-toe with them on his day and be as influential as a McCaw. I'm not saying he's as good, you know, he was as good a player as McCaw, but he was as important for Wales anyway, and for the Lions.
100%. The other person I toyed with the idea of putting him in, he got quite close actually, was Chris Lobshaw, which is a...
That is an interesting pick.
It's an interesting pick, not just because he's English, but also because many would argue he's not a 7. The thing I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, 2015 Chris Lobshaw saying we don't lose at home was and then losing at home to Wales was joyous. And at that point, he's sunk in my estimation. I know it was sponsorship, it wasn't him lighting those lines, but yeah, he had sunk about as low as he could get in my estimations. But like Brian Moore, actually, he managed to sink very low, and then he's just constantly on being on the way up since then. I think some of the performances he put in after that 2015 World Cup, when it was pretty clear that his England days were over, were absolutely brilliant. Mm. And whether he's a 7 or a 6.5 or a 6 or not in a squad, he is fairly hardworking. I think he was a not particularly successful captain, but he embodied, I think he embodied what makes a good captain. Like he might not make great decisions, but he worked harder than probably anyone else on the team. And you got the impression that you would be happy taking orders from him because you knew that he was working harder than anyone else.
It's interesting one, isn't it, with Rob Shaw? Because I'd say I would be in that bracket that said he wasn't an international 7. I thought he was an excellent 6. He would have been an excellent 6, 6.5, whatever you want to call it. And I think, again, some of his decisions as a captain, most notably that game against Wales, will kind of come back to haunt him. But for all of that, I think if he'd have been playing in, let's say, an England back row now, if he was wearing 6 with either Underhill or Curry at 7 and Vunipola at 8, I think you've got a very different he's going to be judged in a very different way there. So I agree. I think he kind of was in that in between period. I do think he's a little bit underestimated as a player.
I also think if he played for Wales, I think we'd love him because he's clearly he puts his all into it. He's not a 7 unless you're going to play a kind of a different style of rugby. But he got really close. RG Surveyor also had a shout. I like his style of rugby. I think he's a very exciting player. But to be honest, he's not the best in the world. And he's also doesn't have a particular emotional connection, or I don't have a particular emotional connection to him. So he was going to be out of the running, but he was certainly within a shot. But the person I went for, and this might be a little bit left field, was Alex Popham.
Interesting. At 7 as well.
I kind of thought, I'm a little bit agnostic about 6, 7.
Yeah.
Less so 8, but 6 and 7, I kind of can see them switching around. So I wouldn't mind Barkley playing 7, Popham playing 6. My 8, without giving away who he is, my 8 could also bounce between probably not 7 but 6 as well. So I would quite like to do some quite inventive things with that, with my 6, 7, 8.
Let's talk about more about Alex Popham to start with, because he came very close to making my side actually. Just there was the period when Wales were we were very very poor, kind of 06, 07, and he was a player who really shone in that side. And in part because of his peroxide hair.
yes.
But his hits were just absolutely phenomenal. And I was just at that stage where I just loved watching big ball carrying back row forwards and people who put in big hits. And no one epitomised that more than Popham, really.
100%. I mean, the other thing was he played for both the Tykes and the Scarlets. Mm. So that gives him a big head start. I remember watching a Tykes game, probably late 2002, early 2003, I guess, when Popham was early 20s, and we started leaving. We actually didn't start leaving, but we walked down to be pitch side, just because we'd always watched from kind of stood up relatively high up in the stands, and so we thought we'd go pitch side and just see what it was like there. And he made a hit which actually it scared me. Like, the noise that the guy he hit made was just unbelievable. It was like the kind of it's like someone stamping on a crisp packet. it was unbelievable. And I think as happens with a lot of things, you see one player do something either really good or really bad, and then that sticks in your head. And so obviously he was a great tackler, but after watching that up close, it just felt like every tackle he made since then was just an absolute monster. And also he was, you know, obviously you see it a lot more now, but he was quite good at bouncing around. You know, he went Newport, Tykes, Scarlets, believe.
Well, that's the reason he didn't make my side, you see. If he'd have stayed in Newport and then gone to the Dragons, he would have got the nod. But I just couldn't forgive him. I couldn't forgive him for leaving Newport in the first place, which is what I held against it. But from your point of view, he played for Leeds and for Scarlets.
Yeah, ironically, him leaving Newport has made me pick him. So if he's listening, he in my view, that was a good choice.
He has been on actually, and yeah, we're hoping to get Alex on again at some point. So maybe you picking him to the side will be the catalyst to get it back on. Put my grudges to bed.
I'd hope that would be the case. There's clearly better players, but I think for me, growing up having a Welsh player in a Tykes squad, that immediately made him a favourite of mine. And then as I kind of knew more about rugby and then watching him progress, I think it was just great to kind of watch how good he got.
And what about eight then? Who completes the back row?
So this was a difficult one. Because I struggle to think of eights that I have a really serious fondness for. And so I kind of going back and trying to think of some of the best performances I've ever seen. And I think it was probably 2010 or 2009 to 2010. Someone I thought was going to be a Welsh legend, or just a rugby legend who was going to completely change the way that the number eight position was played, was Andy Powell. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he never did become that. Maybe he's a Welsh legend for some, but he never kind of, I don't think, fulfilled the potential that I saw in that initial year or so. But watching some of his early performances, he was just incredible.
Yeah, he really, again, another one who kind of came through, started his professional career at Newport, and again, you know, was rough around the edges when he started playing. And again, I can't think how long ago this would have been, maybe 2003, 2004, and you know, there was just so much chat about this young guy at eight, and he had good games and bad games, and then but the raw ability was there for everyone to see, and he. You know, he bounced around a lot in his career and never really settled until he went to Cardiff, and that's when he got in the Wales side and went on the Lions tour. But he strung together some seriously impressive performances in those games.
Yeah, I also think that as a romantic, I just think that the lost possibilities make him high. You know, kind of guaranteed to be on this list because. You know, for anyone else, his career was absolutely exceptional. You know, to imagine as a kid that you would have the career that he had would be unbelievable. But I think a lot of people love him for the fact, you know, for the golf buggy instinct, all that kind of stuff. Like, people love him for that. I just kind of see it as a missed opportunity. Like he was so good. He could have been whatever he wanted to be, really. And it was kind of, you know, it's one of those frustrations where you just kind of want to shake the person and say, look, just you were this good, just be that good again. So I think that kind of made him quite high up the list as well.
But he doesn't get the nod.
No, sorry, he does get the nod. Yeah,
he does get the nod.
Well, yeah.
I tell you what, there's no shortage of ball carrying options in that back row. With Powell and Popham in there, which again, the Newport fan in me would have loved to have seen that kind of on a few more occasions. I don't know if they ever did play together in the same back row, but both huge ball carriers and putting in massive hits.
Yeah, and also, you know, I like switching around players. So there's
possibly Powell moving to second though, Ngakoue moving to eight for certain back though moves off the scrum. Nice. So I can see a lot of possibilities here.
That is a real mixture in the pack of brute force and then some out and out silk as well. I like that a lot. Right, we're looking forward to hearing who you've picked in the back, Sam, and we'll do that in just a moment. But first, we're going to take a very quick break.
I'm Ben John, and you're listening to the Attacking Scrum podcast.
Time now to have a look at your back, Sam. Really interesting pack you've picked there. Talk us through some of the options then when it came to number nine.
So there actually weren't any options apart from the person I picked in number nine. This guy actually got me into playing rugby. Watching him and kind of absolutely idolising him as a kid, and he made me want to play the position that for most of my youth and then early adult rugby I played, and that is Dwayne Peel.
Yeah, I had a feeling you were going to say Dwayne Peel, and he is held in such high regard amongst Scarlet fans, isn't he? And with good reason.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the key things. I actually remember the Scarlets came to play the Tykes. But at that point, I'd certainly seen a lot more Tykes games than I'd seen Scarlets games. And so as we were driving towards the ground, I was saying, I was saying to my dad, who was, you know, kind of, we were Tykes fans when it was only the Tykes playing or Tykes playing other English teams, but we weren't necessarily particularly wedded to them. And him saying, oh, well, you know, you'll probably know when you turn up. You'll know if you want to support the Scarlets or if you want to support the Tykes. Like, you'll probably know when you go into the ground. And this was maybe 2004, possibly. And I was really worried about it. You know, the night before, I was trying to work out, well, if I support the Scarlets, does that mean I don't like the Tykes anymore? If I support the Tykes, does that mean I cannot like the Scarlets anymore? And my dad was absolutely right. As soon as I walked into the ground, I thought, I am supporting the Scarlets. And Dwayne had a great game then. He also had a fantastic game maybe a year before against Sale at Edgeley Park. And he was absolutely incredible. And also, it was just a nice memory. It was a Friday night game, which I think was a surprise. I think I didn't know we were going until the afternoon of the game, and then we kind of went over to Stockport and turned up. And he was just exceptional. And I just remember watching some videos about how his training regime and trying to copy it, and just wanting basically to be him to be honest, for the sort of first 27 years of my life, really, but especially so for the kind of first five or six rugby playing years of my life. So yeah, I think he's made a huge impact on getting me into the game of rugby.
I also think to go back to what you're saying about some of the forwards and that kind of romanticism around perhaps unfulfilled potential, and I do feel like he had more to give and for Wales this is, and you know, although you were very fortunate that Mike Phillips there too, I just feel like at a certain point in time around 2005, I think Dwayne Peel was probably the best scrum half in the world. And I think once he went to Sale, he was kind of overlooked for a bit after that.
Yeah, and I think that's fair, because it's easy to ignore someone when you're not seeing them week in, week out. And to be honest, I wasn't a Sky subscriber or whatever when he was at Sale, so I never really saw that many of his Sale games. And so I did certainly lose touch with him a little bit in that kind of 2008 to 2011 when he stopped playing for Wales period. But yeah, we've had such a good stack of young scrum halves come through. And actually, I wonder how much the kind of the Scarlets' good crop of young scrum halves coming through is down to Peel. You know, also inspiring them in kind of the similar way to how he inspired me to do it. So yeah, I think I just think for so many reasons he was a kind of a guaranteed nine pick.
Awesome pick. Right then, outside half.
So, this one I got a little bit more fun with. Well, I say that actually. I had some in mind and I didn't really deviate from them at the end. But Dan Biggar, I just think, is the in a very different way to kind of why I was toying with the idea of selecting Ken Owens, is that Dan Biggar just plays a game kind of with his heart on his sleeve and just... You know exactly what he's thinking all the time, but he's very calm under pressure, under actual pressure, kicking goals, setting up a back line, moving a back line. He's very calm there. Also, Lees Priestland was in the running. I actually wrote him down before I dispatched him from the fly half position. I mean, what he did in 2011, it really was a World Cup of the non-first choice fly halves, with Stephen Donald kicking the winning kick and then Priestland doing what he did. So he was in with a big shout. Also, as a kid, Ronan O'Gara was a big influence on me, and I've always liked Ireland. I've never quite had the antipathy both towards the Irish that we're meant to have. So I've always liked watching Ireland, and O'Gara was really good, and I love watching him. Also, I could never actually bring myself to pick this guy, but late career Johnny Wilkinson at Toulon.
He was a lot more fun to watch then, wasn't he?
He was a lot more fun to watch. I was backing him a lot more than I ever had at any point in his career, and you could kind of... Once the kind of the anti-English glasses came off for me, I could kind of see why people loved him. I never quite got that before. I saw him as a little bit of a boring kind of operator, stand there, kick goals, drop kick.
I think it's very, very similar to how Northampton fans will probably see Dan Biggar now. Now they've had the opportunity to see him up close and realise how important he is to a side. I think there'd be a lot of English Northampton fans who would be a lot more, who would be a lot more appreciative of Dan Biggar having had him in their team, rather than just the Dan Biggar they see playing for Wales.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. Yeah, but none of those made the pick. The choice I went for, a lot of decision, a lot of effort to try and dislodge him, but I never could. It's Stephen Jones. Aside from the fact that he is a Scarlet's legend, and aside from the fact he's a Wales legend, as a young lad watching him play, I just kind of saw something very exciting about how he played, which I know is kind of probably most people wouldn't associate him as being a very exciting 10, but for some reason something he did just kind of spoke to me, and I was a massive fan of watching him play fly half. And I think him and Peel actually were the two big reasons why I ended up playing rugby, really. And actually, there was a point when I was 19 or 20 maybe, where I was playing senior rugby, but I was playing scrum half, and we didn't have a fly half that week, and so I said, well, I'll give it a go. And despite that being 2011 maybe 2012, I went back and watched some Stephen Jones games from 2005 maybe, and then 2009 as well possibly, or kind of the mid 2000s, and because he was just the person I always kind of, if I was going to play fly half, I wanted to play it like him. So he's just, I just think he's absolutely fantastic. And also the work he did with the Scarlets thing as a backs coach, and the work he's done as a coach in general, I think is just huge, and that is enables him to kind of continue that legacy of being as good as he was as a player, and obviously now being as good as he is as a coach.
And having him and Peel, giving them the opportunity to dust off the boots together once more would definitely be appealing.
Oh, I mean, it'd be incredible. It'd be fairly emotional to watch those two put a shirt back on again.
Absolutely right. Let's have a look at where do you want to go next? The wingers then.
Yeah, let's do the wingers. So
we'll do 11, 12, 13 if you'd like to carry on in that format as well. I'll leave it entirely up to you, sir.
Okay, let's do the two wingers first of all. So, I mean, let's not beat around the bush. One of them, Shane Williams. I watched Wales beat Australia at the Millennium Stadium in, was it 2009 or 2010 the first time?
2008 it was, I think.
Was it 2008? Yeah. Like, 2008. I remember, so first of all, the two Shane Williams tries that he scored there, both scored kind of directly underneath our seats, which immediately kind of was brilliant. And I remember that, I think it might have been the first try, I think it was the first try. He kind of juggles it. So this is where my memory, does he juggle it and then pass, or does he get a pass to him and...
So that game was the one where, yeah, that's the one where Jamie Roberts fractured his skull.
Yes. And then I kept playing.
And then made a 20, 30 yard break for that try. And then, yeah, Lee Byrne gives it to Shane, and I think he juggles and goes over the line.
Yes.
Yeah, but it was a great try.
It was. And there's a moment where, which I think you can watch if the highlights are still available, it's on the highlights, but. He juggles it and then he goes over and everyone's obviously happy, cheering, whatever. And then the highlight comes on, or the replay comes on a bit, and there's this intake of breath as Shane Williams juggles, as we realise what he's done, like how good he was to pick that ball up and go over. And then actually before that game, it was a memorable game. I think it was probably maybe the third time I seen Wales live. The first time was Argentina in 2001, where we lost.
Oh God, yeah, Justin Harris at 10. Yeah.
Yes. And actually, as we walked in, Justin Harris had just scored how many points he scored the week before or 2 weeks before.
That's right, he played a handful of games for Cardiff, hadn't he, and he was straight into 10 in an international game, you know, which is amazing to look back at.
Yes, and then the second one was England before the 2007 World Cup, where we got absolutely obliterated.
Yeah, I was there that day as well. That was rough.
Yes, with Alex King pulling the strings for England, who, and when you realise that he's not an English legend, the ability that with which he took Wales apart on that day was kind of depressing. Before the 2008 Australia game. I was with my dad, and we tried to get a pie to take into the stadium, but then there was a massive queue, and then we'd gone on and tried to get a KFC or a McDonald's or something, but they didn't take cards and we didn't have any cash, and then we kept going towards the stadium. The last place left was a Marks and Spencer's, and we thought, we'll go in there and we'll get something. It's not quite what we had in mind pre-match, but this will be fine. And we got a couple of smoothies and a couple of sandwiches. Headed towards the game, ate our sandwiches, kept the smoothies. And as we were going in, the guy said, you can't bring the smoothies in. And we were like, oh, okay, well, can we drink them? He went, yeah, just go down the corner. There's there's some bings there. You can just drink them. And me and my dad finished our smoothies next to a guy who was necking the remaining three of a four-pack of Special Brew. And it was, we were thinking, this is a very different approaches to how we're watching this game here. But I was then also there when Shane Williams scored after the 2011 World Cup when he retired and scored in the last minute against Australia.
It was do you know what? The game generally felt like an anticlimax.
Yes,
well, I was in the stadium that day. So it felt like an anticlimax until Shane scored. And, because we were never really in the game. I think everyone felt a bit hungover from the World Cup.
Yeah.
And, I don't know whether the players did, but I certainly did. You know, it just felt like, oh, you know, maybe we can get a win today, but we were never really in it. And then Shane went over and the atmosphere changed inside the stadium.
Yes. Yeah, it was a completely pointless game, apart from for the last, the 82nd minute or whenever it was he scored, because we just played Australia in a meaningless game, a couple of weeks before, and it felt completely meaningless, but it, for that one moment, it was worth the ticket price. Shane makes it. I mean, there's a bunch of reasons. I mean, the fact that he was a small guy but punched above his weight and kind of showed other smaller players that you can still make either career or just have fun playing rugby. Everything he's done afterwards, how he's kind of his move to Japan and then his 2013 Lions appearance, just kind of everything he's doing, I just think has kind of worked, and so he's clearly in there. I put him in at 14.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the others I went with were the others I toyed with were Tadzuka and Gwenya. The
PSV.
Yes. Purely for that try against South Africa in 2007, which to this day is, I would say, the second best World Cup try, and the first best is by the person I actually ended up picking.
Let's come on to that in a moment, because there is, within Gwenya, there is an interesting parallel with Shane Williams, in that I don't know if you remember this game, but there was a Heineken Cup quarter final where the Ospreys played Biarritz, possibly in San Sebastian.
Yes,
and Gwenya is the only man I have ever seen skin Shane Williams for pace. Honestly, I can't think of anyone else ever done. He's been, he might have been knocked out of the way by someone at some point, but I've never seen anyone do him for pace other than Gwenya on that occasion.
Yeah, I remember that try. The Osprey, he had a couple of really good tries for Biarritz. There's always that thing. There's also that thing. I was looking at this earlier today. He's only 34, which seems unbelievable. And to be honest, he pretty much achieved. Well, his achievements were exceptional. He played more than 200 times for Biarritz, and so he is an exceptional player, but. Just given that, I wasn't watching any top 12 of being in that kind of 2007 to 2016 period. I feel like for me, he's underrated, and he's kind of, he never quite fulfilled what he did when he beat Habana. But I just think that try is absolutely sensational.
Certainly has his place in history, doesn't he? Highlights reel, YouTube clip, or ITV4 program in the lead up to the World Cup talking about the best tries, that one is always going to feature prominently. So who have you gone for then?
So I went with Kenki Fukuoka. The try that I think is the best, I do genuinely think this, and I can't honestly explain why I think that this is probably the best try I've ever seen in a World Cup, is that one where he stripped the Scottish player whose name's escaping me at the moment.
I know the try. I can't remember which player it was. He strips.
Yeah, and then went over for the try because, first of all, it's such a brilliant defensive read to realise that he has to go up and make that tackle, otherwise he's not got a chance of defending four people on the wing. Then the actual, not just making the tackle, but then stripping the ball. Then the pickup. Before, I mean, it's so close to hitting the ground, and he manages to pick it up. It's like one of those games where someone drops a ball and you have to catch it before it hits the ground.
It's almost like an athletic catch in the outfield in a game of cricket. Those ones where they're kind of juggling it on the boundary. Like, it felt as much that. I know exactly what you mean. Watching that as it happened, as that ball was there and there, you just thought, catches and he scores. And he did, and you're right, that was again, it epitomised what Japan were all about, enterprise and bravery and excitement.
Well, exactly, and even when he catches it, he's still got a hell of a lot of work to do to get to the line. He has to kind of swerve around one person and beating other person for pace. It's just, it's incredible. And I watched that in Tokyo, although I was work on the World Cup website. So although I was kind of at work, as it were, I was surrounded by Japanese rugby fans, and it was incredible. And I think that's one of the, you know, the where you are when you watch a try, I think, makes a big impact. That try genuinely makes me a little bit emotional. I honestly can't explain why, because it's definitely not the best ever World Cup try, just on the face of it. But just everything about it was so wonderful. It would be joyous to have him opposite Shane Williams in that.
It's a great choice, and also as well, I watched that game at home with. My wife was kind of, you know, pottering in and out of the kitchen, and she has very, you know, she doesn't mind. She had no interest in rugby until she met me, and has kind of learned to live with it over the over the years. But she took a real interest in that and found it particularly amusing. His name was Fukioka, and she's, yes, like, that guy, she's like, that guy fuck you over, he's absolutely amazing. and yeah, he managed to kind of live up to that mispronunciation on that occasion against Scotland.
He really did. Also, he wasn't meant to be in the squad for the Ireland game, and then someone got injured and he came in, and then he scored the winning try against Ireland, and then he kind of cemented his way into the starting lineup. So it couldn't be more kind of Hollywood-esque.
I know. Everything about it was Hollywood-esque, really, wasn't it? You know, we talk about that Wales run in 2011 and kind of what that meant. And I can only imagine what watching that entire World Cup must have been like for a Japan rugby fan, on home turf, having been such an underdog to be, such an underdog in 2015 and get that win and knock it out of the groups, and then to host the next World Cup where you've got to deal with the pressure of kind of being expected to get out of the group, and not just getting out of the group, but the weather, almost calling that game off, and all of this kind of stuff alongside it, and then to top the group, it was just, and they were a joy to watch as well.
They were. I mean, that's it. You know, you've seen teams like Georgia kind of push teams close in the past, but you wouldn't necessarily be that excited about their playing style. Obviously it's effective, but it's not necessarily exciting. But Japan, it's just exciting. It was exciting to watch those games, and it's, there's kind of a sadness that it's not going to be in Japan probably in our lifetimes, or, you know, not at least not in the near future. And that, even if it is, are they going to have that same team? Even they might have a better team, but it's not going to be quite as much of an underdog story. So that moment in time, encapsulated by Fukioka making that strip and that try, was, I think, the very best of international rugby, really.
Outstanding. Talk us through your centres now.
So I won't give the short list because it was a very long list, but I went for Jamie Roberts at 12. Again, underrated, I think.
Criminally underrated, I would say.
Yeah, I think the people see him as just this Clash Bowl merchant, get a yard, and that's his job. But defensively, outstanding.
Yeah,
set that Welsh back line. In attack, far better than people see him as. And also, if you do think he was just a Clash Bowl merchant, then that was the job he was being asked to do, and he did it better than anyone else could have done.
Yeah, absolutely agree. Absolutely agree with that. And I look back to that game. I think it was 2009. We played England in Cardiff, and Joe Worsley, I think, got man of the match, and was basically there to do a job on Jamie Roberts. You know, yeah. It was essentially a man marking job. They picked Joe Worsley, who is, you know, one of the, you know, a superb tackler, and but it just showed how influential Roberts was. You know, it was.
Yeah.
And then later that summer to go on and have the series he did with the Lions, you know.
Yeah.
I agree. I think when he finally hangs up his boots, people will realise how important he was to Wales.
Yeah, definitely. For me, 13 is difficult. I toyed with the idea of Brian O'Driscoll, but as brilliant as I think he is, and he's clearly possibly the best ever 13. Certainly one of, probably the best ever Northern Hemisphere 13. I don't have a particularly strong emotional connection to him, just apart from thinking he's amazing and really enjoying watching him play.
Probably actually, it's a strange one, considering, like, you know, I've got some amazing memories of him in 2001 for the Lions, and
yeah.
Then, you know, obviously very bad memories of 2005,
yeah.
Not as bad as, you know, as his memories of me, and then 2009, you know, that partnership that he formed with Roberts. But I suppose just because he was such a good player. And you know, I was—he was just a pain in the ass for Wales.
He was.
You know, he had great games against Wales. He plays like an open side as well, which, you know, is a—it's not like he was just doing brilliant things in attack. It's the fact that, you know, Wales would have a great attack and it would be turned over by the outside centre.
Yes.
And then, you know, obviously he's doing it for Leinster as well. He's just a player that I'm never particularly warm to, despite the fact that you're right. He's the best Northern Hemisphere 13 of all time.
Yeah. I do think the fact he played for Leinster, and I think I've seen more Leinster games than you would expect. Like, you know, the Scarlets Leinster games, and I've never ever seen Scarlets beat Leinster. Not live, anyway. I obviously saw it in the Pro 14, but yeah, that kind of, I think that kept it away. If he had played for, you know, Japan or Wales or you know, someone I didn't see beat me quite so frequently as both Ireland and Leinster, I think he would have probably made the cut. Also, I looked at Jonathan Davis. The thing I struggle with Jonathan Davis is everything he does. Loads of stuff he does is brilliant. He's a fantastic servant for Scarlets and for Wales. I just can't get beyond some of the passes he's done in Evershire, and I do hold it against him. Although that's unfair, I kind of end up holding it against him. And so he couldn't make it. Although
it's definitely unfair, but it's your team, so you go for it.
Yes. So the person I chose. Given that I've just dismissed probably two of the best ever Northern Hemisphere 13s, the first thing I'm choosing is Regan King, New Zealand-born Scarlets player, Regan King, for the very similar reason for why I chose Andy Powell and Nakaawa, is just some of the performances he put in were the very, very best of anyone playing rugby that I've seen live. And obviously not consistent and not for season after season after season, but some of those games, he was just unbelievable. It's actually similar to... I almost put Ty Byrne in for this season, because the consistency of, say, or the quality of, say, six or seven performances in a season just... means that you can kind of remember those games. It can't be true, but I just remember watching Regan King play in the sun for Scarlets, which, you know, obviously wouldn't have happened. But that's kind of the memories I have of him. And I went to watch him play against London Welsh when he had his short jersey legs period. And I guess the fact he came back from Clermont Irving was you know, similar to Stephen Jones, really, or very, very similar to Stephen Jones. So yeah, for me, it's that short period of incredibly intense and brilliant performances has nailed him into the 13 shirt.
Yeah, again, a huge favourite, Parker Scarlett's, and yeah, just the silkiest of skills.
Yes.
Again, you know, I think he obviously he's had his troubles off the pitch, but certainly just all the ability in the world on the pitch.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Right. Having said that, I do think I worry that I did Jonathan Davis a disservice. It wasn't intentional, but it is still Regan King.
No, it's an excellent choice. Right, what about fullback then?
So. Stuart Hogg was an early favourite for this, although...
Yeah, I love Stuart Hogg. I absolutely love watching him play. I really do.
Yeah, he's very similar to Nakaawa Powell King. Some of the performances I do think are probably the best ever fullback performances I've seen. And so for that, I considered him. Obviously, Lee Harfeng, I thought long and hard about just the way he puts his body on the line to make those tackles is just incredible. I kind of struggled to get beyond that, though, because the third person I hit on was the person I just couldn't nudge, who I've already said that there's been two of the best tries in World Cup history. I think that this might be the best try in World Cup history, which again, there's going to be a lot of bests. I worry about being hyperbolic about this, but this try has become, you know, internationally famous. And my fullback is Ayumu Golomalu, who was brilliant for exactly four games and arguably was only brilliant in two of them in 2015. He was exceptional against South Africa in what was probably the best ever of the match I've seen. And he scored that try in the corner off the line out. That was just outstanding. And also, one of my favourite moments is the kick at the end, which just didn't matter. They already won the game, whether he kicked it or not. He missed it, and just the look of as if, well, I literally don't care. I would rather have not taken that kick. I couldn't care less about that. And so I just think, how many players have played in the best rugby World Cup game of certainly the 2000s onward? Arguably,
I think the only game that is comparable for drama is, potentially the 2003 final. But I don't think it's necessary. It doesn't give you the story that game in Brighton did. The only one that I think comes close is the semi-final in 99, where France came back and blew the All Blacks away. But even then, I think I would still be tempted to go for the Japan Springboks game.
Yeah, it's difficult to compare, isn't it? Because some of them are joyous and for different reasons. I think the Japan South Africa game, you were hoping for maybe a decent clash where Japan stay in it for 40 minutes and then are blown away in the second half, and it looked like maybe that was what's going to happen, but they just stayed in it. And I think that to be honest, given how I've tried to go about picking these on a kind of an emotional level, anyone who was part of what I think is probably the best rugby game I've seen, who scored one of the best rugby tries I've ever seen, just will be not nailed on, but was a very good win with a very good shout of getting this. And that try he made and that tackle even he made against Scotland in the corner was just absolutely exceptional. So yeah, for those four games in 2015, I have to give it to Golomalu.
Here. Right, let's have a quick recap of the team before I ask you to name your captain, name the opposition, the stadium you'd like the game to take place, and the kit you'd like the side to wear. So the side is Gethin Jenkins, Dane Coles, Adam Jones, Alan Wynne-Jones, Leonie Nakarawa, Johnny Barkley, Alex Popham, Andy Powell. And then in the backs, Dwayne Peel, Stephen Jones, Kenki Fukioka, Jamie Roberts, Regan King, Shane Williams, and Goromaru. Ayumu Goromaru, I forgot his first name there. Yep. Ayumu Goromaru at fullback.
Yes.
Right. Who is going to be the skipper out of those?
It's Alan Wynne-Jones. There's no suspense there. It's Alan Wynne-Jones.
Right then. Like you say, it's been kind of a very emotional tinge to selecting the side. Is there a similar choice when it comes to picking the stadium? Have you gone for one that's particularly particularly close to your heart?
Yeah, I have. I'm still slightly torn on this one,
But I think it's going to be... So the only other thing of this, as brilliant, obviously, as I think the Millennium Stadium is, it is without... it is subjectively the best rugby stadium in the world. But I toyed with the idea of a Friday night game at Headingley Stadium as a 12-year-old boy eating some chips on the terrace watching Leeds Tykes playing under the lights on Friday. That was absolutely joyous. But I've chosen also a Friday night game at Straggy Park. I want it to be rebuilt with the slope and the general awfulness of a lot of it. But I want that to be rebuilt and for the game to take place there.
And the choir and everything else that goes with it.
Exactly, everything else that goes with it.
Fine choice. Okay, so the opposition then?
Well, this one I found difficult. So it was going to have to be England. I wasn't sure what era. So I told you the idea of England 2019 just because, you know, they were the team I'd have liked to have beaten. But given the... given what it did to my childhood, being English, being a Welsh fan in English school, it would be the England 2003 team.
Yeah, I can certainly identify with that. And then, finally, then what jersey would you opt for? Which kit would you go for?
Toyed with 2015 Japan, which I think is beautiful. But ended up going for the 2005 Wales kit with the little white flicks over the shoulder and the white collar. The one that looked so good on Gavin Hengston as he kicked that that 40 or 50 metre kick from the corner to...
just a little splash of green in there as well. Just like a tiny little bit of green on the... tiny little bit of green piping on there. That was a real classy shirt, that one.
Yeah. I don't actually think that Wales have had a better kit since then. It was beautiful. I'd happily see us go back to that.
Good stuff. Fantastic, Sam. It's been a real pleasure chatting to you and getting your thoughts on your Dream 15 and everything else that goes with it. Thank you very much for joining us, and hopefully we'll get you back on the show soon.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Everyone thinks I had a storybook career, that I just sprang into Disney Channel stardom overnight, made millions, and lived happily ever after. Spoiler alert, I didn't. There were countless failures along the way, and there still are. How I deal with that struggle and how I pivot when failure creeps in is what allows me to keep going, keep learning, and keep striving for balance. The Vulnerable Podcast is an invitation to hang out every week with me, Christy Carlson Romano, as I invite friends, celebrities, and experts for in-depth conversations discussing the good, the complicated, the beauty of being human, and what it means to be vulnerable. Join me every Tuesday as we navigate the ups and downs of my guests' paths to success.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com. Sports Social Podcast Network.